theory and Bolshevism probably also exerted some influence. Russia was coming already before the putsch to loom larger in Hitler's thoughts on foreign policy. He had somewhat vaguely mentioned the land question, comparing Germany unfavorably with Russia in its relation of population to the land at its disposal as early as December 1919. He already hinted in a speech on the 31st of May 1921, through praise of the Brest-Litovsk Treaty of 1918, which had ended Russian participation in the war, for giving Germany the additional land it needed to sustain its people at an expansion of German living space at the expense of Russia. On the 21st of October 1921, he was still speaking, somewhat cryptically, of an expansion with Russia against England opening up an unlimited possibility of expansion towards the east. Such remarks indicated that at this time Hitler still shared, even if vaguely expressed, the pan-German view on eastern expansion. This amounted broadly to the notion that eastern expansion could be carried out through collaboration with a non-Bolshevik Russia, whose own territorial demands would be settled also through looking eastwards towards Asia, leaving the former Russian border areas in the west to Germany. It would have amounted, essentially, to something like a resurrection of the Brest-Litovsk arrangement, while Russia would have been left to find compensation in the lands on its own eastern borders. By early 1922, these views had shifted. By now Hitler had abandoned any idea of collaboration with Russia. He saw no prospect of Russia looking only eastwards. Extension of Bolshevism to Germany would prove an irresistible urge. The logic of the changed position was evident. Only through the destruction of Bolshevism could Germany be saved. And at the same time, this, through expansion into Russia itself, would bring the territory which Germany needed. During the course of 1922, perhaps reinforced towards the end of the year by contact with the arch-expansionist Ludendorff, the changed approach to future policy towards Russia was consolidated. By December 1922, Hitler was explaining in private to Eduard Scharrer, co-owner of the Münchner Neueste Nachrichten and favorably disposed towards the Nazi Party, the outline of the foreign alliance ideas which he was to elaborate in Mein Kampf. He ruled out the colonial rivalry with Britain that had caused conflict before the First World War. He told Scharrer, "Germany would have to adapt herself to a purely continental policy, avoiding harm to English interest. The destruction of Russia with the help of England would have to be attempted. Russia would give Germany sufficient land for German settlers and a wide field of activity for German industry. Then England would not interrupt us in our reckoning with France." In the light of his comments to Scharrer, it can scarcely be claimed that Hitler developed an entirely new concept of foreign policy while in Landsberg, one based on the idea of war against Russia to acquire Lebensraum. And what he wrote in Mein Kampf on Germany's need for land being satisfied at the expense of Russia had indeed already been anticipated in an essay he wrote in spring 1924, which was published in April that year. There was no transformation of Hitler's vision of the world in Landsberg. What he came to write in Landsberg was the result of the gradual gestation of his ideas, rather than a flash of intuition, set of new insights, or overnight conversion to a different approach. The imperialist and geopolitical ideas that went to make up the idea of Lebensraum were in fact common currency on the imperialist and folkish right in Weimar Germany. As we noted in an earlier chapter, the idea of Lebensraum had been a prominent strand of German imperialist ideology since the 1890s. It had been strongly represented in the Pan-German League under Heinrich Klass, supported by the press controlled by founder member of the League, director of Krupps, and media tycoon Alfred Hugenberg. For Pan-Germans, Lebensraum could both justify territorial conquest by evoking the colonizing of Slav lands by Teutonic knights in the Middle Ages, and, emotively, conjure up notions of uniting in the Reich what came to be described as Volksdeutsche, ethnic Germans scattered throughout Eastern Europe. For the most part, these constituted fairly small minorities, as in the parts of Poland outside the towns which Prussia had ruled before 1918. But in a number of areas, Danzig, for example, parts of the Baltic, or the area of Czechoslovakia later known as the Sudetenland, the German-speaking population was sizable and often vociferously nationalist. The idea of Lebensraum symbolized then for pan-Germans the historic conquest of the East, while at the same time, in emphasizing German alleged overpopulation, cloaking real, modern, power political, imperialist ambitions. It existed alongside, rather than blending with, the mainstream imperialist concentration on overseas trading colonies encapsulated in the slogan of Weltpolitik. In the Weimar era, it came to be popularized by Hans Grimm's best-selling novel, Volk ohne Raum, People Without Space, published in 1926. Hitler could scarcely have avoided the imperialist and geopolitical writings in circulation on living space. Among them, whether read at first hand or in bowdlerized form, it seems highly likely that Haushofer's were one significant source for his notion of Lebensraum. Through Rudolf Hess, Hitler already knew Karl Haushofer, the leading exponent of geopolitics, by 1922 at the latest. Haushofer's influence was probably greater than the Munich professor was later prepared to acknowledge. If he was not acquainted with them before, Hitler certainly had time on his hands while in prison to read his works, as well as those of Friedrich Ratzel, the other foremost geopolitics theorist. Whether he did so or not cannot be proved, but it seems at the very least likely that the broad lines of their arguments were made known to him by Haushofer's former pupil, Rudolf Hess. At any rate, by the time of the Schara discussion at the end of 1922, Hitler's thinking on Russia and the living space question was essentially in place, and by spring 1924, his views were effectively fully formed. What Landsberg and the writing of Mein Kampf did was to provide elaboration. Beyond that, it showed that Hitler had by then firmly established the link between the destruction of the Jews and a war against Russia to acquire Lebensraum. Already in the first volume of Mein Kampf, the choice, which Hitler had still rhetorically left open in his article of April 1924, of a land policy directed against Russia with Britain's support, or a world trading policy upheld by sea power directed against Britain with Russia's support, was emphatically determined. By the second volume, mainly written in 1925 and published at the end of the following year, the enemy in the short term was still seen as France. But in the boldest language, the long-term goal was now stated to be the attaining of living space at the expense of Russia. The right to possess soil can become a duty if without extension of its soil a great nation seems doomed to destruction, wrote Hitler. Germany will either be a world power, or there will be no Germany. And for world power, she needs that magnitude which will give her the position she needs in the present period, and life to her citizens. And so we National Socialists consciously draw a line beneath the foreign policy tendency of our pre-war period. We take up where we broke off 600 years ago. We stop the endless German movement to the south and west, and turn our gaze towards the land in the east. At long last, we break off the colonial and commercial policy of the pre-war period, and shift to the soil policy of the future. If we speak of soil in Europe today, we can primarily have in mind only Russia and her vassal border states. For centuries, Russia drew nourishment from the Germanic nucleus of its upper leading strata. Today, it can be regarded as almost totally exterminated and extinguished. It has been replaced by the Jew. He himself is in no element of organization, but a ferment of decomposition. The giant empire in the East is ripe for collapse. And the end of Jewish rule in Russia will also be the end of Russia as a state. The mission of the National Socialist Movement was to prepare the German people for this task. We have been chosen by fate, wrote Hitler, as witnesses of a catastrophe which will be the mightiest confirmation of the soundness of the Volkisch theory. With this passage, the two key components of Hitler's personalized worldview, destruction of the Jews and acquisition of living space, came together. War against Russia would, through its annihilation of Jewish Bolshevism, at the same time deliver Germany its salvation by providing new living space. Crude, simplistic, barbaric, but this invocation of the most brutal tenets of late 19th century imperialism, racism, and anti-Semitism, transposed into Eastern Europe in the 20th century, was a heady brew for those ready to consume it. Hitler himself repeatedly returned to the living space notion, which became a dominant theme of his writings and speeches in the following years. His foreign policy ideas were to be more clearly laid out, but in no significant way altered in his second book, written in 1928, though left unpublished in Hitler's own lifetime. Once established, the quest for Lebensraum, and with it the destruction of Jewish Bolshevism, would remain a keystone of Hitler's ideology. One element remained to complete the worldview, the leader of genius who would accomplish this quest. In Landsberg, Hitler found the answer. 4. Many years later, Hitler regarded the self-confidence, optimism, and belief that simply could not be shaken by anything more as deriving from his time in Landsberg. Hitler's self-perception did indeed alter while he was in prison. Even at his trial, as we have seen, he had been proud to be the drummer of the national cause. Anything else was a triviality, he had declared. In Landsberg, this changed, though, as we have noted, the change had already been underway during the year preceding the putsch. Hitler was preoccupied from the beginning of his sentence with the question of his own future and that of his party after his release. Since he expected his release within 6 months, the question was an urgent one. For Hitler, there was no turning back. His political career, which had developed into his political mission, left him nowhere to go but forwards. He could not return to anonymity, even had he wanted to do so. A conventional bourgeois lifestyle was out of the question. Any retreat after the acclaim he had won on the nationalist right at his trial would have confirmed the impression of his opponents that he was a figure of farce and would have exposed him to ridicule. And as he pondered over the failed putsch, transforming it in his mind into the martyr's triumph that would come to have its central place in Nazi mythology, he had no trouble in assigning the blame to the mistakes, weakness, and lack of resolve of all the leading figures to whom he was at the time bound. They had betrayed him and the national cause. This was his conclusion. More than that, the triumph at his trial, the torrents of adulation ever present in the Völkisch press, or pouring unabated from letters sent to Landsberg, and, not least, the collapse of the Völkisch movement in his absence into derisory sectarian squabbling and the growing conflict with Ludendorff and the other Völkisch leaders, all these contributed towards giving him an elevated sense of his own importance and of his unique historic mission. The idea, embryonically forming in 1923, took firm hold in the strange atmosphere of Landsberg. Surrounded by sycophants and devotees, foremost among them the fawning Hess, Hitler now became certain. He himself was Germany's coming great leader. Such a notion, in its full implications, was unimaginable before his triumph at the trial and the acclaim that followed. The heroic leadership he now claimed for himself was an invention of his followers before he saw himself in that role. But the role fitted the temperament of one whose personal failures in early life had found an exaggerated wish fulfillment in unbound admiration for heroic figures, above all, the artist hero Wagner. Whether an extraordinary depth of self-loathing is a necessary precondition for such an abnormal elevation of self-esteem into that of the heroic savior of the nation is a matter best left to psychologists. But whatever the deep-seated reasons for such a narcissistic egomaniac as Hitler, the hero worship which others directed towards him, combined with his own inability to find fault or error in himself, now produced a heroic leadership self-image of monumental proportions. No one in mainstream German political life, outside the tiny and fractured Völkisch movement, was aware of or would have taken seriously the change in Hitler's self-perception. At the time, it was of no consequence. But for Hitler's demands on the Völkisch movement, and for his own self-justification, it was a vital development. In Mein Kampf, Hitler pictured himself as a rare genius who combined the qualities of the programmatist and the politician. The programmatist of a movement was the theoretician who did not concern himself with practical realities, but with eternal truth, as the great religious leaders had done. The greatness of the politician lay in the successful practical implementation of the idea advanced by the programmatist. Over long periods of humanity, he wrote, it can once happen that the politician is wedded to the programmatist. His work did not concern short-term demands that any petty bourgeois could grasp, but looked to the future with aims which only the fewest grasp. Among the great men in history, Hitler singled out at this point Luther, Frederick the Great, and Wagner. Seldom was it the case, in his view, that a great theoretician was also a great leader. The latter was far more frequently an agitator. For leading means being able to move masses. He concluded, the combination of theoretician, organizer, and leader in one person is the rarest thing that can be found on this earth. This combination makes the great man. Unmistakably, Hitler meant himself. The idea he stood for was not a matter of short-term objectives. It was a mission, a vision of long-term future goals, and of his own part in the accomplishment of them. Certainly, these goals, national salvation through removal of the Jews and acquisition of living space in the East, did not amount to short-term practical policy guidelines. But, incorporated into the notion of the heroic leader, they did amount to a dynamic worldview. This worldview gave Hitler his unremitting drive. He spoke repeatedly of his mission. He saw the hand of Providence in his work. He regarded his fight against the Jew as the work of the Lord. He saw his life's work as a crusade. The invasion of the Soviet Union, when it was launched many years later, was for him, and not just for him, the culmination of this crusade. It would be a serious error to underestimate the ideological driving force of Hitler's few central ideas. He was no mere propagandist or unprincipled opportunist. He was indeed both a masterly propagandist and an ideologue. There was no contradiction between the two. Hitler's conviction of his own uniqueness conveyed itself to some, if not all, of those imprisoned alongside him in Landsberg. It was only in Landsberg, wrote Rudolf Hess, that he fully grasped the mighty significance of Hitler's personality. Some of the inmates, like Hess, would, on release, be instrumental in transmitting the heroic image of Hitler within the party. Hermann Wobke, Hitler's liaison with the North German faction, and an internee in Landsberg, along with around 24 other young members of Hitler's bodyguard, gave an indication of the impression Hitler was making on him in one of his letters to the Göttingen leader of the National Socialists, Ludolf Haase. It is my rock-solid conviction that Hitler will not move one iota from his National Socialist thinking. And if it nonetheless sometimes looks as if that is the case, then it is only for the sake of more important goals. For he combines in himself the programmatist and the politician. He knows his goal, but also sees the ways to accomplish it. My stay here has strengthened what I still doubted in Göttingen, the faith in Hitler's political instinct. When he left Landsberg to try to rebuild a crippled movement, Hitler's leadership claims were therefore not only externally enhanced within the Völkisch movement, but had been inwardly transformed and consolidated into a new perception of himself and awareness of his role. His sense of realism had by no means altogether disappeared beneath his messianic claims. He had no concrete notion of how his aims might be achieved. He still imagined that his goals might be brought to fruition only in the distant future. Since it consisted of only a few basic, but unchangeable tenets, his worldview was compatible with short-term tactical adjustments, and it had the advantage of accommodating and reconciling a variety of otherwise conflicting positions on particular issues and fine points of ideology adopted by subordinate Nazi leaders. Within the framework of his basic worldview, Hitler himself was flexible, even indifferent, towards ideological issues which could obsess his followers. Opponents at the time, and many later commentators, frequently underestimated the dynamism of Nazi ideology because of its diffuseness and because of the cynicism of Nazi propaganda. Ideology was often regarded as no more than a cloak for power ambitions and tyranny. This was to misinterpret the driving force of Hitler's own basic ideas, few and crude as they were, and it is to misunderstand the ways those basic ideas came to function within the Nazi Party then, after 1933, within the Nazi state. What mattered for Hitler was indeed the road to power. He was prepared to sacrifice most principles for that, but some, and those were for him the ones that counted, were not only unchangeable. They formed the essence of what he understood by power itself. Opportunism was always itself ultimately shaped by the core ideas that determined his notion of power. Following his months in Landsberg, Hitler's self-belief was now such that, unlike the pre-putsch era, he could regard himself as the exclusive exponent of the idea of National Socialism and the sole leader of the Völkisch movement destined to show Germany the path to its national salvation. The task facing him on release would be to convince others of that. 8. Mastery over the movement. Duke and liegeman, in this ancient German relationship of leader to companions, lies the essence of the structure of the NSDAP. Gregor Strasser, 1927. I subordinate myself without further ado to Herr Adolf Hitler. Why? He has proved that he can lead. On the basis of his view and his will, he has created a party out of the United National Socialist idea and leads it. He and the party are one and offer the unity that is the unconditional premise of success. Ernst Graf zu Reventlow, a former critic of Hitler, 1927. Between the refoundation of the NSDAP in February 1925 and the beginnings of the new political and economic turmoil that was to usher in the shattering impact of the world economic crisis, the Nazi movement was no more than a fringe irritant in German politics. Its leader, Hitler, faced with the rebuilding of his party from scratch after it had fractured into warring factions during his imprisonment in 1924 and banned from speaking in public in most of Germany until 1927, in the biggest state of all, Prussia, until 1928, was confined to the political wilderness. A confidential report by the Reich Minister of the Interior in 1927, pointing out that the NSDAP was not advancing, realistically described the party as a numerically insignificant, radical revolutionary splinter group incapable of exerting any noticeable influence on the great mass of the population and the course of political events. In the conditions of economic recovery and apparent consolidation that prevailed in the 4 years following the currency stabilization, the major props of Nazi success before 1923 were removed. A semblance of normality came over the Weimar Republic. These were Weimar's golden years. With Stresemann at the helm, the Locarno Treaty of 1925, recognizing the western borders of the Reich as determined in the Versailles Treaty, and Germany's entry into the League of Nations the following year brought the country back into the international fold. At home, despite nationalist opposition, the Dawes Plan took much of the heat out of the reparations issue by regulating and substantially easing the rate of German repayment. It would be 5 years before the issue became sensitive again when a further attempt, the Young Plan, in 1929, to establish terms for clearing the reparations burden, stirred a new wave of nationalist agitation. Meanwhile, despite governmental instability, the new republic seemed to be settling down. Beneath the 4 changes of administration between 1925 and 1927, there was a good deal of continuity in government coalitions. In the economy, after a sharp but short-lived recession in 1926, industrial production for the first time came to surpass the pre-war level. Real wages did the same. The welfare state made impressive progress. Health provision was far superior to the pre-war period. Public spending on housing increased massively. By the later 1920s, over 300,000 new houses a year were being built, a level to be reached in only 2 years during the Third Reich. Industrial disturbances fell. So did crime levels. The first glimmers of a mass consumer society were visible. More people had radios, telephones, even cars. Shopping was increasingly carried out in big department stores. In all this, Germany in the mid-1920s followed patterns recognizable in much of Europe. America was the model, though Germany lagged far behind. These years also marked the high point of Weimar culture, of Neue Sachlichkeit, new objectivity, and the thriving of an extraordinary cultural avant-garde. The modernist architectural experiments of the Bauhaus, the expressionist painting of leading artists such as Paul Klee and Wassily Kandinsky, the biting social commentaries in the pictures of Otto Dix and caricatures of Georg Gross, the bold new musical forms attained by Arnold Schoenberg and Paul Hindemith, the cynical genius of Bertolt Brecht's plays, all became synonymous with Germany's cultural preeminence in the 1920s. Mass entertainment also flourished. Sporting events drew increasing numbers of spectators. Boxing, football, and motorsports were especially popular. Cinemas and dance halls sprouted up on urban street corners. The Charleston, shimmy, and jitterbug were the rage. Young people in big cities were more likely to be attracted to hot jazz than to Heimatlieder. In the countryside, life continued at a more leisurely pace. Apart from a few cases of fire, there are no notable disturbances of public safety to report, began the sleepy half-monthly dispatch of the government president of Upper Bavaria in February 1928. 5 years earlier, his reports had been dominated by the activities of Hitler and his movement. It was as if a storm had burst in 1923. The calm that followed held out little hope of future success for the Nazi Party. The Volkisch Right's residual support had dwindled to around 3% of the population by late 1924. In the 1928 Reichstag election, this fell still further. The NSDAP, campaigning in a Reichstag election for the first time under its own name, gained a mere 2.6% of the vote. Over 97% of the electorate did not want Hitler. Under the present-day constitution of the Federal Republic, the Nazis' percentage of the vote would have gained them no seats at all. Even under the Weimar electoral system, only 12 Nazis took their seats among the 491 deputies returned to the Reichstag. Growing unrest in farming communities and agitation surrounding the Young Plan helped the NSDAP to improve on this disastrous performance in regional elections in 1929. Even so, without the depression and the calamitous effect upon Germany from the end of that year, the Nazi Party may well have broken up and faded into oblivion, remembered essentially as a passing phenomenon of the post-war upheaval. Hitler himself would have been recalled as a one-time firebrand who burnt his fingers in an absurd putsch attempt and never again became a force in German politics. As long as the German economy offered prospects of recovery and future prosperity, the fragile political fabric of the new democracy did not collapse. Without such a collapse, and as long as the anti-democratic elites, with a leverage on power, particularly the army leadership, but also the big landowners, many of the captains of industry, and the top echelon of the civil service, retained their detached loyalty to the Republic, there was little or nothing that Hitler and his party could do to gain a foothold in the mainstream of politics, let alone to stake a claim to power. However, it is as well not to be dismissive of the importance of these wilderness years between 1924 and 1929 in laying the platform for the later triumphant rise of Hitler and the Nazi Party. During this period, Hitler became incontestably established as the leader of the radical right. In the process, the NSDAP was transformed into a leader party of a unique kind, with the character it was to retain and later to impart to the German state. Hitler by this time was no conventional party chairman, nor even a leader among others, primus inter pares. He was now the leader. Between 1925 and 1929, at first with some difficulty, he had established outright and complete mastery over his movement. By 1929, the organization of the party, which had been built up to accompany its nationwide expansion, however thinly spread at first, bore little comparison with the hand-to-mouth administration of the pre-putsch party, and placed it in a far stronger position to exploit the new crises that descended on Germany from the autumn of that year. The activist cadres had also grown in strength. Despite its miserable showing at the polls, the party's own figures of 100,000 members in October 1928 were almost twice as high as the membership rolls on the eve of the putsch. Though the voters were still few in number, the activist core of mainly dedicated fanatics was relatively large. Finally, though the factionalism inherent in radical rightist movements still simmered just below the surface, not infrequently breaking through into open conflict, the NSDAP was a far more cohesive force by 1929 than it had been before the putsch. And by then, its rivals on the extreme right had disappeared, lost all significance, or been absorbed into the Nazi movement. These developments were strongly influenced by Hitler's changed leadership position. As we have noted, Hitler was, before the putsch, only one of the leaders of the right, and with the main emphasis in 1923 on paramilitary politics, heavily dependent upon forces outside his own movement. Despite the beginnings of the leadership cult which some of his followers attached to him, he was still regarded at that time as merely one exponent, however important, of National Socialism, with its myriad forms of emphasis and interpretation. By 1929, his dominance in the movement was absolute, the idea now as good as inseparable from the leader. The Hitler cult had caught hold among the party faithful in ways scarcely imaginable before 1923, and was now well on the way to elevating the leader above the party. For some leading figures in the party, the cult was encouraged, or at least tolerated, because it served successfully as the focus of growing support. Above all, it was accepted because it was a crucial adhesive, alone capable of holding together the party, which otherwise, as 1924 had shown, was likely to splinter into feuding factions. But for opponents and for supporters alike, National Socialism came in these years to mean exclusively the Hitler movement. The platform was created for the subsequent rapid spread of the leader cult once the breakthrough of popular support had been attained in 1930, and for the later near deification of Hitler in the Third Reich itself. Hitler's own contribution to the transformation of the NSDAP in these years should not be exaggerated. What is remarkable indeed is not how much, but how little, Hitler personally had to do to bring about the restructuring of the NSDAP in these years, so that it was in a position to challenge for power once circumstances again began to favor it. In essence, Hitler's crude scheme of the path to national redemption and rebirth remained as it had been since his entry into politics: mobilization of the masses, takeover of the state, destruction of internal enemies, preparation for external conquest. His ideological vision was, at this stage at least, of importance mainly in further rationalizing to himself the prejudices and phobias he had long carried with him, and in conveying a compelling image of a political visionary to his followers. His sole recipe, as always, was to work for the nationalization of the masses through ceaseless propaganda and agitation, and to wait for events to turn in his favor. The certainty that they would do so, the certainty of the fanatic, impressed those drawn to his message. It helped to shape the aura around Hitler, the messianic, visionary image. However, the growth of the Führer cult, though Hitler did nothing to prevent it other than prohibiting its most tasteless excesses, was brought about by his followers. And the important restructuring of the party's organization was largely the work of Gregor Strasser. Hitler's indispensability to the Völkisch Right had been demonstrated when it disintegrated during his time in Landsberg. No other leader could rally it and hold it together as he could, and no speaker could draw the crowds like he could. Beyond that, his main contribution to the inner strengthening of the NSDAP in this period amounted to an uncompromising stance, even in adversity, towards all potential threats to his authority, and the utilization of his unique leadership position to bypass or override all ideological conflicts in the single-minded pursuit of power. Despite the modest growth from a low base in party support in 1929, neither Hitler nor any other leading Nazi had any inkling about the speed with which the political breakthrough was to follow. But once the breakthrough came, the party was, following the changes since its refoundation in 1925, in a position to exploit the new conditions it had been powerless to produce. 1. Hitler spent Christmas Eve 1924 with the Hanfstengels in their splendid new villa in Munich's Herzogpark. He had put on weight during his time in prison and looked a little flabby. His blue suit was flecked with dandruff on the collar and shoulders. 4-year-old Egon Hanfstengel was glad to see his uncle Dolf again. Within 2 minutes, Hitler was asking to hear Isolde's Liebestod on Hanfstengel's elegant Blüthner grand piano. Wagner's music, as Hanfstengel had often noticed, could transform Hitler's mood. His initial nervousness and tension disappeared. He became relaxed and cheerful. He admired the new house, then suddenly stopped in mid-sentence, glanced over his shoulder, and explained that he had not lost his habit from prison of imagining he was being observed through the peephole. It was, as Hanfstengel realized, a pathetic piece of play-acting. Putzi had seen Hitler in Landsberg, relaxed and comfortable, and there had been no peephole in his room. He noticed that Hitler had a good appetite during the meal of turkey, followed by his favorite Viennese sweet pastries, but that he scarcely touched the wine. Hitler subsequently explained that he had begun on leaving Landsberg to cut out meat and alcohol in order to lose weight. He had convinced himself that meat and alcohol were harmful for him. And in his fanatical way, went on Hanfstengel, finally made a dogma out of it, and from then on only took vegetarian meals and alcohol-free drinks. After the meal, Hitler treated the family to his war memories, marching up and down the room, imitating the sounds of different sorts of artillery fire at the Battle of the Somme. Late in the evening, a well-connected artist, Wilhelm Funk, dropped in at the Hanfstengels. He had known Hitler for quite some time, and now ventured his views on how the party could be built up again. Hitler replied in a familiar and revealing tone. For one who had come up from the bottom, he said, without name, special position, or connection, it was less a matter of programs than hard endeavor until the public was ready to see a nameless one as identical with a political line. Hitler thought he had now reached that position, and that the putsch had been of value to the movement. I'm no longer an unknown, and that provides us with the best basis for a new start. The new start was Hitler's priority. The immediate aim was to have the ban on the NSDAP lifted. His first political act was to call on his old ally, Pirner, the former Munich police president. Through a well-placed intermediary, Theodor Freiherr von Kramer-Klett, a meeting with the Bavarian minister-president Heinrich Held was arranged for the 4th of January. Pirner was also influential in persuading Gertner, the Bavarian Minister of Justice, whom Hitler was to make Reich Minister of Justice in 1933, to have the other Nazis detained in Landsberg released, among them Rudolf Hess. The meeting with Minister-President Held on the 4th of January, only a fortnight after Hitler's release, and the first of 3 meetings between the two, went well. No one else was present. Hitler was prepared to act humbly. It was his journey to Canossa. He agreed to respect the authority of the state without condition and to support it in the struggle against communism. He distanced himself sharply from Ludendorff's attacks on the Catholic Church, a necessary step since the general's vociferous anti-clericalism, scarcely a winning formula in Bavaria, had recently become notably strident and linked to an all-too-public row involving a court case for libel, which Ludendorff lost, with Ruprecht, the Crown Prince of Bavaria. Behind the public facade of continued reverence for the figurehead of the Folkish movement, Hitler's willingness during his meeting with the Bavarian Premier to dissociate himself from Ludendorff was not only shrewd, but also a sign of his increasing estrangement from the general, which would rapidly accelerate into complete alienation by 1927. Not least, Hitler promised Held, an easy promise to make in the circumstances, that he would not again attempt a putsch. Held told Hitler in the most forthright terms that times had changed. He would not tolerate any return to the sort of circumstances that had prevailed before the putsch, nor would the constitutional government treat the revolutionaries of yesterday as an equal partner. But Hitler got what he wanted. With Gertner's backing, the way was now paved for the removal of the ban on the NSDAP, and the Volkische Beobachter on the 16th of February. By that time, Hitler's relations with his rivals in the NSFB had been clarified. A meeting of the NSFB in Berlin on the 17th of January marked the effective end of the attempt to create a unified Folkish movement. Reinhold Wüller, one of the original DVFP founders, sought to undermine Hitler's authority, especially among the strong North German contingent present. He accused Hitler of being worn out through his imprisonment and of giving in to the international power of the Catholic Church. Wüller reckoned this to be a bigger threat than the Jewish danger. The point carried some weight among Folkish leaders in the Protestant North. He also suggested that under Hitler's weakened leadership, Bavarian particularism would come to dominate. It would be South against North. Playing to his audience, Wüller emphasized his own Prussian orientation. Clever politicians were needed in the present conditions. Hitler was not one of them. Henning, another co-founder of the DVFP, was even plainer. Hitler was perhaps the drummer, but no politician. Another vehement critic claimed that Hitler wanted to be Pope of the movement, to which he had contributed nothing, and accused him of breaking his word of honour. Greffe reinforced the accusation. He said he passed no judgment on Hitler. The facts spoke for themselves. The alleged breach of trust was seen as Hitler's refusal to answer a letter by Greffe earlier in January, effectively posing him an ultimatum to break his links with the Streicher and Esser faction, or the DVFP would go its own way. The accusations produced a tumult. The National Socialists present were outraged. The meeting ended with the swapping of insults and all hopes of unity in the Folkish movement dead. A glimpse of National Socialist thinking at the meeting can be gleaned from the comments of Walter von Korswant-Kunzow, later Gauleiter of Pomerania. Rather, he said that the one leader in whom one has most trust fails than this hither and thither of the many from whom everybody wants something different. I now believe in the godly grace of Hitler, whom I have personally never seen, and believe that God will enlighten him now to find the correct way out of this chaos. The patent inability to reach any basis of unity in the Folkish movement over the previous year made increasing numbers now susceptible to such sentiments. But not everyone in the Folkish movement felt the same way. Some still stated openly that Ludendorff was the leader they wanted. There was said to be a rising anti-Hitler mood in one of the Munich branches of the NSFB after the Nazi leader had brusquely refused to meet a deputation from the branch for even a few minutes and had stated that its written submission had gone, like all others he received, unread into the waste paper basket. Hitler himself was concerned only with the removal of the ban on his party in Bavaria, which he knew was imminent. He was prepared to undertake nothing which would jeopardize it. He let the North German National Socialists know, however, that he had no intention of entering into any pact with Greffe's Freedom Party, and that a statement refounding the party throughout the Reich would be made once the ban was lifted. He insisted that his hands were free. He had entered into no political arrangements and had promised Helt only that he would not undertake a putsch. As regards his relationship with Ludendorff, he commented, referring to the position he had adopted during the days of the pre-putsch Kampfbund, and, subsequently at his trial, he had viewed the general only as the military leader, with himself as the political leader. The only breach of faith towards Ludendorff, he added, had come from those who had dragged his name through the swamp of the Parliament, devaluing it in the process. He wanted only true National Socialists in leadership positions after the refoundation. Far from being worn down by his imprisonment, he was more flexible than ever. But his line was unchanged, the fight above all against Marxism. Its positive expression was the nationalization of German workers. As for his attitude towards the heavily criticized leaders of the GVG, Streicher, Esser, and Dinter, Hitler had a characteristic reply. All that mattered for him, he stated, was what those concerned had achieved. Streicher had built a following of more than 60,000 supporters in Nuremberg, more than the Reich leadership of the NSFB had in the remainder of Bavaria. He could not offend these supporters for the sake of any personal antipathy. By mid-February, events were moving Hitler's way. On the 12th of February, Ludendorff dissolved the Reich leadership of the NSFB. Shortly afterwards, just before the lifting of the ban on the party, Hitler announced his decision to refound the NSDAP. A flood of declarations of loyalty to Hitler now poured in. At a meeting at Hamm in Westphalia on the 22nd of February, Gauleiter of the former NSFB from Westphalia, the Rhineland, Hanover, and Pomerania, together with over 100 district leaders from the northern provinces of Germany, attested anew their unshakable loyalty and adherence, Gefolgschaft, to their leader Adolf Hitler. The refounded NSDAP would not, unlike its pre-putsch predecessor, be largely confined to Bavaria. On the 26th of February, the Furkische Beobachter appeared for the first time since the putsch. Hitler's leading article, On the Renewal of Our Movement, placed the emphasis on avoiding recriminations for the divisions in the Furkisch movement and, learning from past mistakes, on looking towards the future. There was to be no place in the movement for religious disputes, a necessary disclaimer in mainly Catholic Bavaria, and a criticism of the Furkisch movement which had accused Hitler of making concessions to Catholicism. He refused to accept any external conditions limiting his own leadership, proclaimed the aims of the movement as unchanged, and demanded internal unity. His call to former members in the same edition struck the same tone. Where party members rejoined, said Hitler, he would not ask about the past, and would concern himself only that past disunity should not repeat itself. He demanded unity, loyalty, and obedience. He made no concessions. What was on offer was a Pax Hitleriana. The newspaper also carried the new regulations for the reformed NSDAP based on the statutes of July 1921. Leadership and unity were once more the keynotes. All splits were to be avoided in the struggle against the most terrible enemy of the German people, Jewry and Marxism. The SA was to return to the role of party support troop and training ground for young activists that it had occupied before becoming incorporated in the Bavarian paramilitary scene in February 1923. This was to prove, within weeks, the breaking point with Ernst Röhm, who, unable to persuade Hitler to agree to retaining the SA as a conventional paramilitary organization, withdrew from political life and departed for Bolivia. Entry into the refounded party could only come about by taking out new membership. There could be no renewal or continuation of former membership. This had both symbolic value and also accorded with the stipulation of centralized control of membership from Munich. Retention of his Munich power base was vital to Hitler. When Lüdecker suggested moving the headquarters to Thuringia, strategically well situated in central Germany, associated with Luther and the cultural traditions of Weimar, in a Protestant area which did not have to reckon with the opposition of the Catholic establishment, as in Bavaria, and not least, a region with an existing strong base of Furkisch sympathizers. Hitler conceded that there was something to be said for the idea. "But I can't leave Munich," he immediately added. "I'm at home here. I mean something here. There are many here who are devoted to me alone, and to nobody else. That's important." At 8 o'clock on the evening of the 27th of February, 1925, Hitler, with his usual sense of theatre, made his re-entry to the Munich political scene where he had left it 16 months earlier, at the Bürgerbraukeller. The meeting had originally been envisaged for the 24th, but that was Fasching Tuesday, so the Friday was settled upon. Just as before the putsch, red placards advertising the speech had been plastered around Munich for days. People began to take up their seats in the early afternoon. 3 hours before the scheduled start, the huge beer hall was packed. Over 3,000 were jammed inside, 2,000 more turned away, and police cordons set up to block off the surrounding area. Some prominent faces were missing. Rosenberg was one. He was irritated at being excluded from Hitler's inner circle in the weeks since his return from Landsberg. He told Lüdecker, "I won't take part in that comedy. I know the sort of brother-kissing Hitler intends to call for." Ludendorff, Strasser, and Röhm were also absent. Hitler wanted the first party leader, Drexler, to chair the meeting, but Drexler insisted that Hermann Esser be evicted from the party. Hitler would accept no conditions. And for him, Esser had more political sense in his fingertips than the whole bunch of his accusers in their buttocks. So, one of Hitler's most trusted Munich followers, his business manager Max Amann, opened the meeting. Hitler spoke for almost 2 hours. The The first three quarters of his speech offered his standard account of Germany's plight since 1918, the Jews as the cause of it, the weakness of bourgeois parties, and the aims of Marxism, which, he stated, could only be combated by a doctrine of higher truth but similar brutality of execution. Hitler was frank about the need to focus all energy on one goal, on attacking a single enemy to avoid fragmentation and disunity. The art of all great popular leaders, he proclaimed, consisted at all times in concentrating the attention of the masses on a single enemy. From the context, it was plain that he meant the Jews. Only in the last quarter of the speech did Hitler arrive at his real theme of the evening. No one should expect him, he said, to take sides in the bitter dispute still raging in the Folkish movement. He saw in each party comrade only the supporter of the common idea, he declared, to lasting applause. His task as leader was not to explore what had happened in the past, but to bring together those pulling apart. At last, he came to the climacteric. The dispute was at an end. Those prepared to join should sink their differences. For 9 months, others had had time to look after the interests of the party, he pointed out with sarcasm. To great and lasting applause, he added, "Gentlemen, let the representation of the interests of the movement from now on be my concern." His leadership had, however, to be accepted unconditionally. "I am not prepared to allow conditions as long as I carry personally the responsibility," he concluded, "and I now carry again the complete responsibility for everything that takes place in this movement." After a year, he would hold himself to account. There were tumultuous cheers and cries of Heil. Everyone stood for the singing of Deutschland über alles. Then came the finale. It was a piece of pure theatre, but it had symbolic meaning, not lost on those present. Arch-enemies over the past year and more, Hermann Esser, Julius Streicher, Arthur Dinter from the GVG, Rudolf Buttmann, Gottfried Feder, Wilhelm Frick from the parliamentary Volkischer Bloc, mounted the platform, and among emotional scenes, with many standing on chairs and tables, and the crowd pressing forward from the back of the hall, shook hands, forgave each other, and swore undying loyalty to the leader. It was like medieval vassals swearing fealty to their overlord. Others followed. Whatever the hypocrisy, the public show of unity, it was plain, could only have been attained under Hitler as leader. He could with some justice claim to have restored the homogeneity of the party. In the following years, it would become more and more apparent. Hitler and the idea increasingly embodied in his leadership constituted the sole indispensable force of integration in a movement that retained the potential to tear itself apart. Hitler's position as supreme leader, standing over the party, owed much to the recognition of this fact. Outside loyalist circles, the immediate response to Hitler's speech on the Folkish Right was often one of disappointment. This was mainly because of the way Hitler was plainly distancing himself from Ludendorff, still seen by many as the leader of the Folkish movement. In his proclamation of the 26th of February, Hitler had referred merely in bland terms to the general as the most loyal and selfless friend of the National Socialist movement. In his speech he had not mentioned Ludendorff at all. Only in the scenes that followed, as calls of Heil to the general were heard in the hall, had he spoken, diplomatically but vaguely, of belonging to him in heart, even though he had not referred to his name. Ludendorff's supporters saw Hitler's treatment of him as a calculated insult. Ludendorff's standing remained a potential problem. But, as so often, luck came to Hitler's aid. On the 28th of February 1925, the day after the refoundation of the NSDAP, the first Reich President of the Weimar Republic, the Social Democrat Friedrich Ebert, died at the age of 54 from the effects of an appendicitis operation. The right had so persistently tried to defame him for his participation in the munitions strike of January 1918, when the SPD leadership had become involved in the unrest, demanding democratization and peace without annexations, that spread from the Berlin armaments factories, bringing a million workers out on strike, temporarily threatening war production, and later fostering the stab-in-the-back legend, that he had been forced to defend himself in 170 libel cases. Such was the feeling against Ebert, and such was the level of anti-socialism in conservative Catholic as well as in nationalist circles that the Archbishop of Munich and Freising, Cardinal Faulhaber, who had notoriously on one occasion dubbed the 1918 revolution high treason, refused to have the church bells rung in his diocese in honor of the dead president. The NSDAP had no expectation of having any significant influence on the election of Ebert's successor. Hitler openly as good as admitted this. He told a party meeting that it was immaterial who became Reich president. Whoever it was would be only a man who is in reality no man at all. But against the arguments of some of his advisers, Hitler insisted on putting forward Ludendorff as the National Socialist candidate and persuaded the general to stand. He regarded the general as no more than a token candidate without a chance of winning. Why Ludendorff agreed to stand is less easy to understand than why Hitler wanted the candidacy of a rival of whom he was by now, in private, extremely scathing. It seems that Hitler persuaded the general that the conservative candidate of the right, Karl Jahres, had to be stopped, and, flattering Ludendorff's prestige, inveigled him into standing. Hitler knows perfectly well that although he has a great following in Bavaria, he can count on very few votes in North Germany and east of Berlin, the general told his dismayed wife, who immediately foresaw the likely consequences to which the arrogant former warlord was blind. In particular, the East Prussians and Silesians have been bound to me by gratitude and devotion ever since the war, he went on, his mind made up. They, in fact, showed their gratitude and devotion by almost completely ignoring him in the poll. Probably Ludendorff reckoned, too, with the backing of his Folkish friends. But when the DVFB decided, in order not to split the right-wing vote, to put their support behind Jahres, the general's fate was effectively sealed. What had seemed to some in Hitler's entourage a risky strategy was, in fact, no great risk at all, and was more or less guaranteed to damage Ludendorff. That this was the intention was scarcely concealed, even by some leading Nazis. For Ludendorff, the election on the 29th of March was a catastrophe. He polled only 286,000 votes, 1.1% of the votes cast. This was 600,000 fewer than the Folkish Right had gained at the Reichstag election in December 1924, itself a disastrous result. Hitler was anything but distressed at the outcome. "That's all right," he told Hermann Esser. "Now we've finally finished him." The election winner in the runoff on the 26th of April was another war hero, Field Marshal Hindenburg. Weimar democracy was now in the hands of one of the pillars of the old order. Not only did the National Conservative Right vote for him, had the BVP and the KPD supported the Centre Party's candidate Wilhelm Marx instead of the BVP perversely supporting the candidate of the reactionary right and communists sticking with Ernst Thälmann, Hindenburg would have lost. The price would be paid heavily in 1933. Ludendorff never recovered from his defeat. Hitler's great rival for the leadership of the Folkish Right no longer posed a challenge. He was rapidly on his way into the political wilderness. Influenced by Mathilde von Chemnitz, who in 1926 would become his second wife, he had since, around 1924, become increasingly susceptible to a persecution complex, bound up with conspiracy theories, which included Freemasons, Jews, Marxists, and also Jesuits. His increasing eccentricity, bolstered by Mathilde's even greater zaniness, now took him increasingly to the fringes of the radical right, itself scarcely renowned for its cool rationality. The curious sect he and Mathilde founded in 1925, the Tannenbergbund, published a wealth of literature which was so harebrained in its persecution paranoia that even Nazi ideologues rejected it. Not only was Ludendorff no longer of any use to Hitler, he was outrightly counterproductive. By 1927, Hitler was openly attacking his former ally and accusing him of Freemasonry, an accusation which was never countered. The Folkish movement itself in 1924, numerically stronger and geographically more widespread than the NSDAP and its successor organizations, was not only weakened and divided, but had now effectively lost its figurehead. At first, especially in southern Germany, there were difficulties where local party leaders refused to accede to Hitler's demand that they break their ties with Folkish associations and subordinate themselves totally to his leadership. But increasingly they went over to Hitler. Most realized the way the wind was blowing. Without Hitler, they had no future. For his part, Hitler was particularly assiduous during the coming months in visiting local party branches in Bavaria. The ban on speaking at public meetings, which the Bavarian authorities had imposed on him,